Imagine it is midnight in a quiet suburb of Osaka. The air is thick with the scent of rain and ozone. The streets are empty save for the hum. You turn a corner and there it is. A monolith of plastic and glass, glowing with a fierce artificial hunger. A vending machine. In any other country, this is a convenience. In 1985, Japan, it was a sanctuary. It was proof that the world was good. You didn't need to fear the dark because the machine was always there, providing, serving, never sleeping. It was the ultimate symbol of the safety myth, the collective agreement that we were all looking out for one another. But tonight, the machine has a secret. Down in the retrieval slot, where the metal is cold and the shadows pool like ink, sits a bottle. It shouldn't be there. It's a found fortune. A cold brown glass bottle of Oronamin C. The Phantom didn't need to chase you. They didn't need to break into your home. They simply waited for you to be polite. They waited for you to see the waste of a forgotten drink and decide to claim it. They were hunting with the deadliest bait ever devised. Human decency. The horror began in Fukuyama. It began with Haruo Otsu, a man who believed in the myth. On April 30, 1985, he reached into that dark metal slot and felt the condensation of a bottle he hadn't paid for. He didn't know he was shaking hands with a ghost. The liquid inside Oronamin C is a bright, vitamin-infused gold. It's meant to give you energy, to sharpen your mind, to help you endure the long hours of Japanese work weeks. But the Phantom had added a different kind of energy. When Haruo twisted the cap, he heard the snap of the seal. It felt right. It felt safe. He took a long, deep swallow. He didn't die in the street. That wouldn't have been cruel enough for the Phantom. No, Paraquat is a patient predator. It waited until Haruo was home. It waited until he was in bed, dreaming of the next day. It began as a subtle heat in the back of his throat, a strange metallic aftertaste that wouldn't go away. By the next morning, the heat had turned into a fire. Every swallow felt like jagged glass. By the time he reached the hospital, the fire had moved to his chest. The doctors in Fukuyama looked at his lungs and saw something they couldn't explain. It wasn't an infection. It was a transformation. The soft pink tissue that allows us to draw life from the air was being methodically, chemically, turned into wood. The Phantom had delivered the blue death. To understand the horror of what was happening inside Haruo, you must understand the poisoned. Paraquat, C12H12N2Cl2. To a farmer, it is a tool to clear the earth. To a human being, it is a biological eraser. The poison is dyed a brilliant, warning blue, so that no one could ever drink it by accident. But the Phantom was an alchemist of the dark. They knew that when you mix the blue of the poison with the gold of the drink, it disappears into a murky, undetectable amber. They used a needle so thin it left no mark, pierced the plastic and the metal with the precision of a surgeon. Once Paraquat enters your blood, it has a single destination, your lungs. It is redox active. It begins a cycle of chemical violence that produces superoxide radicals, microscopic shrapnel that shreds your cells from the inside out. But it doesn't just kill the cells, it forces the body to repair them with scar tissue. This is the true horror of the Paraquat method, the conscious drowning. Paraquat doesn't touch the brain. Haruo Otsu sat in his hospital bed, his mind perfectly clear. His memories intact, his love for his family undimmed. He watched the sun rise and set through the hospital window, fully aware that he was dying. He wasn't sick in the traditional sense. His heart was strong, his kidneys were fighting, but his lungs were hardening. Imagine trying to breathe through a stone. Imagine your chest expanding, your muscles straining, but the air simply won't go in because the tissue has lost its song. It has become a block of unyielding fiber. You are drowning in a room full of oxygen. You are a prisoner in a body that has forgotten how to be human. Haruo died on May 4th. He was the first sacrifice to the machine. The Phantom was not satisfied with one sacrifice. They were a gardener of the night and they were ready for the harvest. In September, the bottles began to appear everywhere, like a virus spreading through the veins of the Japanese infrastructure. The poisoned gifts were found in Shizuoka, in Mie, in Osaka. On September 11th, a man named Shoichi found his luck in a retrieval slot. He was dead in 3 days. On September 12th, a 22-year-old student, a boy who probably spent his evening studying and dreaming of a career in the neon towers of Tokyo, found a bottle. He didn't die quickly. He lingered for 2 weeks. Can you imagine those 14 days? The student lying in a sterile white room, his textbook still in his bag, while the blue poison methodically turned his youth into scar tissue. His parents would have sat by his side, perhaps bringing him water that he couldn't swallow, watching him gasp for air that wouldn't come. The police were paralyzed. They weren't dealing with a man, they were dealing with a void. Every time they checked the machine, the Phantom had already moved on. There were no fingerprints. The glass was wiped clean, as if polished by a careful hand. There were no witnesses because no one looked at the man stocking a machine. In 1985, a man in blue coveralls was invisible. He was part of the background noise of the city. The Phantom was a ghost who used the safety myth as a cloak of invisibility. By October, the terror had reached a fever pitch. The vending machine Phantom was the only topic of the conversation in the noodle shops and the boardrooms. But the Phantom added a new layer to the horror, the indiscriminate choice. Usually, a killer has a type. They hunt the vulnerable, or the beautiful, or the rich. But the Phantom didn't care. They left the bottle for whoever was honest enough to take it. On October 21st in Kyoto, the poison found a 55-year-old man. On October 28th in Saitama, a 44-year-old man found two bottles, a double gift. He drank them both, perhaps thinking he had hit a jackpot of convenience. His death was a long, slow-motion catastrophe. He lived for a month of watching his own breath fail him, a month of the blue death claiming his lungs inch by inch. The police profile of the killer was a portrait of a monster made of nothing. They looked for a disgruntled farmer, but the locations were too urban. They looked for a failed scientist, but the method was too simple. They looked for a technician, but the geography was too wide. The truth was more terrifying. The killer was anyone. They were the man standing next to you on the subway. They were the delivery driver who smiled at you in the morning. They were the shadow you saw out of the corner of your eye as you walked past the glowing monolith of the corner. Then came November, and with November came the end of the safety myth. The victim was a 17-year-old girl this time from Saitama. She was young, she was vibrant, she was the future of the economic miracle. She saw a bottle of Oronamin C sitting in the tray of a machine on her way home from school. She was a child of a trusting nation. She took the gift. She was the 13th death. When the news of her passing hit the wires, the nation stopped. This wasn't just a crime anymore. It was a violation of the womb. If a schoolgirl couldn't trust the street she walked on, then the safety myth was indeed a lie. The industry finally broke. Otsuka Pharmaceutical and the other giants realized that the gift was now a curse. They recalled millions of bottles. They spent millions to reinvent the very act of drinking. This was the birth of the pop. The companies realized they had to make a safety sound. They created the tamper-evident cap, that metallic snap and the plastic ring that falls away. They gave the public a mechanical reassurance. If you didn't hear the pop, the Phantom was inside the bottle. And then, as if they had achieved their goal, the Phantom vanished. No one ever was arrested. No confession was ever found in a suicide note. The vending machine phantom simply stepped back into the shadows of the neon world and became a ghost once again. But the Blue Death never truly left. It lived on in the eyes of every mother who pulled her child away from a vending machine. It lived on in the silence of Oita Peninsula. It lived on in the hardening lungs of the 13 who were lucky enough to find a free drink. Now close your eyes and imagine a room. It is small, cramped, a typical 1K apartment on the outskirts of an industrial district in Osaka. The only light comes from a single buzzing fluorescent tube that flickers with a rhythmic dying heartbeat. Outside, the world is moving at the speed of the 1980s, but inside this room, time is congealed into something thick and suffocating. On the low table sits a row of amber glass bottles. Oro Ramen C. Oh yes, they look innocent. They look like the promise of health. But next to them sits a plastic jug, its label partially torn, revealing a warning in bold black kanji. Within that jug is a liquid of such an intense artificial blue that it seems to swallow the light around it. Paraquat. The herbicide. The earth killer. The phantom moves with the slow, deliberate grace of a priest performing a ritual. They don't use a mask. They don't need to. There is no one to see. They reach for a box of medical-grade syringes, tools stolen from a clinic's dumpster, or perhaps bought under a false name from a supplier who didn't ask questions. The needle is a 30-gauge. It is as thin as a strand of a widow's hair. The phantom draws the blue venom into the plastic chamber. It is precise in dose, enough to ensure the hardening, but not so much that it alters the viscosity of the golden drink. They pick up a bottle. They don't remove the cap. To do so would break the spell. Instead, they find their microscopic vulnerability where the metal cap meets the glass rim. The needle slides in. There is no resistance, no sound. With a steady thumb, the phantom depresses the plunger. The blue dye hit the amber liquid, and in a moment of dark chemistry, it vanishes. It is a camouflage of the most sinister order. The bottle is wiped down with a cloth soaked in alcohol, removing any trace of a fingerprint, any ghost of a touch. The phantom places the bottle into a blue nylon bag. They have 12 more to prepare that night. Then the city is thirsty, and the phantom is ready to provide. By October 1985, the Japanese police were no longer just investigating a crime, they were hunting a demon. The safety myth had been replaced by a state of siege. In the ancient city of Kyoto, where the spirits of the past are said to walk the streets, a new kind of ghost had taken up residence. The Kyoto Prefectural Police received a tip, the kind of tip that keeps a detective awake until his eyes bleed. A witness claimed to have seen a man in a dark hat leaning over a vending machine in the late hours of the night, not far from a high-rise apartment complex that housed hundreds of anonymous workers. The detective moved like a shadow. They set up a sting. For 72 hours, officers sat in unmarked cars, their breath fogging the windows, watching the glowing monolith of the machine. They did not speak. They did not move. They waited for the man in the hat. On the third night, a figure emerged from the concrete labyrinth of the high-rise. He walked with a heavy, rhythmic gait. He approached the machine. The detectives felt their hearts hammer against their ribs. This was it. The end of the nightmare. The man reached into his jacket. He pulled out a bottle. He reached toward the retrieval slot. Police, don't move.
警察だ、動くな!
The detectives swarmed. They pinned the man against the glowing plastic of the machine. They tore the bottle from his hand. Their flashlight cut through the dark, illuminating the label. It was the bottle of tea, unopened, unpoisoned. This man wasn't the phantom. He was a night shift worker who had bought a drink earlier in the day, finding it was too warm, and was coming back to see if he could exchange it or simply leave it for someone else. A gesture of the very motainai that the killer was exploiting, that trust in society. The Kyoto lead turned into a pile of ash. The police had captured a ghost, only to find out it was just a man caught in the crossfire of a nation's paranoia. The real phantom was likely miles away, watching the news in a different prefecture, laughing silently as the safety myth continued to crumble. We must talk about victims not as statistics, but as people who were extremely unfortunate. But as people who were perceived as lucky, because that is how it started for every one of them. Imagine you are a salaryman in Mei Prefecture. You've worked a 14-hour shift. Your head is throbbing and your throat is a desert of dust and exhaustion. You reach the machine, you see the gift. In the horror stories of old, a vampire must be invited across the threshold. The Paraquat Phantom understood this. They didn't force the poison down anyone's throat. They invited the victim to invite the poison in. One survivor of the panic, not a victim, but someone who had found a bottle and chose not to drink it, shared his story with a Shukan magazine in late 1985. I saw it sitting there. It looked so cold, so perfect. I actually picked it up. I felt the weight of it in my hand. I remember thinking, someone forgot their luck today. I almost twisted the cap, but then I noticed a tiny, tiny smear of something on the glass. It looked like a water spot, but it was perfectly circular. A shiver went down my spine. Not because I knew about the poison yet, but because it felt like someone was watching me. I put the bottle back. 3 days later, I saw the news. I realized I had been holding my own shroud. This is the psychological horror of the Paraquat spree. It turned the lucky break into a death sentence. It made the entire population second-guess their own good fortune every time a Japanese citizen found a coin on the ground or a forgotten umbrella, they felt the cold breath of the phantom on their neck. The evidence in the Paraquat cases was a series of nothings. The fingerprint void. The police processed over 3,000 bottles from machines across the country. They found thousands of prints belonging to technicians, delivery drivers, and curious children. But they never found a single reoccurring print that didn't belong to the machine's ecosystem. The phantom was a ghost who wore gloves. The syringe mystery. The needles used were so common that they were untraceable. In 1985, Japan was a hub of medical manufacturing. Millions of these syringes were produced every month. Trying to find the one used by the phantom was like trying to find a specific grain of sand in the Sahara Desert. The blue testimony. One forensic pathologist noted that the most haunting piece of evidence wasn't the bottle, but the hands of the deceased. Because paraquat is a concentrated dye, the victims often had a faint, almost imperceptible blue tint to their fingernails beds in the final hours of their lives. It was as if poison was marking its territory, reminding the world that the Blue Death owned this body now. The lungs were already stone. The blood was already stagnant. The blue stain was the phantom's signature, writing in the chemistry of the dying. The Paraquat murders didn't end with the bang. There was no grand finale. The 17-year-old girl in Saitama died. The industry changed its caps and the phantom just stopped. This is the ultimate horror for a storyteller. We want a villain to be unmasked, to scream his motives to the heavens while the handcuffs click shut. But the phantom denied us that. They gave us the ultimate nocturne, a story that ends in a cold, grey fog. The safety myth was patched with pop caps and security cameras, but the soul of the nation had been altered. The vending machine was no longer a friend. It was a mechanical stranger. And we also have the copycat summers of the 90s to explore, alongside the chemical profile of 2010 to analyze. We have to ask the most terrifying question of all for these upcoming cases. Is the phantom still alive? Well, if they were 25 in 1985, they are only 66 today. They could be standing in line behind you at a convenience store. They could be the elderly man feeding pigeons in the park. They could be watching this very investigation, a small knowing smile on their lips as they hear the metallic pop of a bottle being opened nearby. And to understand the Paraquat Phantom, you must first strip away everything you think you know about murder. We are used to the passionate killer, the one who strikes in a red haze of rage, fueled by a specific grudge or a twisted desire. We are familiar with the predatory killer, the one who stalks a specific victim, hunting for a type, a look, a vulnerability. But the Phantom was something else. They were a digital killer in an analog world. They were an indiscriminate architect. The psychology of the indiscriminate killer is a descent into a cold, airless room where empathy has been replaced by curiosity. A dark, clinical interest in the breaking point of a society. The Phantom didn't want your money, and they didn't even necessarily want you. They wanted to witness the collapse of an idea. Most killers require proximity. They need to see the light leave the eyes. They need to feel the heat of the struggle. This is a visceral, biological drive, but the Phantom chose a mechanical proxy. By using the vending machine, the killer created a psychological buffer. This is a concept known as moral disengagement through displacement. In the killer's mind, they didn't kill Haruo Otsu or the schoolgirl in Saitama. The machine did. The victim's own choice did. The Phantom provided the poison, yes, but the victim provided the hand that reached into the slot. The victim provided the thirst. The victim provided the trust. To the indiscriminate killer, this isn't murder, it's a collaboration. It is a grotesque game where the killer sets the board and the victim moves the piece that leads to their own checkmate. This detachment allowed the Phantom to maintain a sense of innocence. They could go home, eat dinner with their family, and sleep soundly, telling themselves, "I didn't force anyone. I just left a gift." It was their choice to take it. It is the psychology of a trap setter, a person who finds more joy in the potential of the kill than the kill itself. There is a specific kind of narcissism in the indiscriminate killer. They are the director of a play where they are the only person who knows the script. When the news broke out about the first death in Fukuyama, the Phantom wasn't just a spectator, they were the author. Imagine them standing at a newsstand, reading the headlines about the Blue Death, feeling a surge of electric power that no salaryman's paycheck could ever provide. This is the God complex of the void. In a society as structured and rigid as 1980s Japan, where your life is often mapped out from primary school to retirement, the ability to inject chaos into the system is the ultimate form of rebellion. The Phantom was a nobody who became a deity. They could reach out from the cramped apartment and stop the breath of a man 300 miles away. They didn't need to be there to see the suffering. The suffering was a mathematical certainty. The paraquat was the variable, and the hardening of the lungs was the result. The killer found satisfaction in the inevitability, the nihilism of the bubble, and the contrast of the golden age. We must look at the nocturne of the 1980s. Japan was at its zenith. The economic miracle had turned the nation into a neon playground of excess. Everyone was getting rich. Everyone was moving forward. But for someone like the Phantom, this progress was a mask. Beneath the neon, there was a growing sense of social alienation. In Japanese psychology, there is a concept of ura, the hidden internal side, and omote, the public visible face. The Phantom was a manifestation of a corrupted ura. They were the shadow cast by the bright lights of the Ginza. Indiscriminate killers often suffer from a profound sense of anome, the feeling that social norms and values have lost their meaning. If the safety myth says we are all protected, and yet I feel alone and miserable, then the safety myth is a lie. And if it is a lie, I am justified in tearing it down. The Phantom didn't attack people, they attacked the communal trust. They poisoned the vending machine because the vending machine was the most visible symbol of a society that worked. By making the machine a monster, they made the society a monster. One of the most chilling aspects of the paraquat psychology is the choice of the poison itself. As we established, paraquat is a slow killer. If the Phantom wanted immediate results, they would have used cyanide. But cyanide is too fast. It's a pop and a drop. There is no story in cyanide. Paraquat, however, creates a narrative of agony. The killer knew that their victims wouldn't die in the street. They would go to the hospital. They would be featured on the nightly news. Their families would give tearful interviews. The doctors would hold press conferences looking baffled and defeated. The Phantom was a voyeur of the aftermath. They enjoyed the consensual drowning because it lasted for weeks. It gave the killer time to savor the impact. It allowed them to watch the nation go through the stages of grief and terror in real time. Every day the victim lingered was another day the Phantom was the most powerful person in Japan. It is the psychology of the slow burn. The thrill isn't the explosion, it's the sight of the fuse disappearing into the dark, knowing exactly what is coming and knowing that no one on earth can stop it. Most killers look for weakness. The Paraquat Phantom looked for virtue. Think about who takes a bottle from a vending machine slot. It isn't the cynical person. It isn't the person who suspects the world is out to get them. It is the person who believes in the old ways. It is the person who thinks, someone left this. It would be a waste to leave it here. I am lucky today. The Phantom was specifically hunting the trusting. This reveals a deep-seated resentment of innocence. The killer likely viewed their victims not as people but as fools, who believed in a world that the killer knew was broken. Every death was a lesson being taught to the public. You think you are safe? You think the machine is your friend? You think the world is honest? Let me show you the blue truth. This is the psychology of the corruptor. The goal isn't just to kill the body, but to kill the belief. And in 1985, the Phantom succeeded. They turned every vending machine into a witness to a murder that hadn't happened yet. The most haunting psychological question is, why did they stop? In most horror stories, the monster keeps feeding until it is killed. But the Phantom was different. They were disciplined. The psychology of the stopping suggests one of two things. The goal was satiated, the killer didn't have a blood quota, they had a terror quota. Once the industry changed, once the pop caps were introduced, and once the entire nation was living in a state of permanent suspicion, the Phantom had won. The safety myth was dead. There was nothing left to prove. The master of the exit. There is a terrifying power in the unfinished story. By vanishing, the Phantom became immortal. If they had been caught, they would have been a pathetic man in a courtroom. By staying in the shadows, they remained above it all. They chose to end the play while the audience was still screaming. While the shadows of 1985 were long and cold, they did not manage to extinguish the light of the Oita Peninsula or the vibrant heart of Japan. Today, the safety myth has evolved into something even more powerful. A safety reality built on innovation and the unwavering resilience of a people who refuse to let fear dictate their lives. The machines still stand on every corner, but they are no longer traps. They are beacons of a culture that learned to protect its own. When you hear that crisp, metallic pop of a fresh bottle today, it is more than just a seal breaking. It is the sound of a world that chose to be better, safer, and more connected. The blue shadow has receded, and in its place is the warmth of a community that looks out for one another, proving that even the most clinical phantom cannot break the human spirit. Despite all its reach, despite the deaths it's caused, it was still not able to create a permanent grip on Japanese culture and the Japanese community. The neon still glows, the trust has been restored, and the white night has finally given way to bright, clear morning. Now, listeners, thank you so much for listening. This is a first-parter in my Japanese true crime and unsolved crime series. I'll be focusing on Japanese true crime over the next couple of episodes. Let me know what you think, leave some comments, email me on storiesfablesghostlytales@gmail.com on any true crime suggestions you might have, or swing on by my Patreon to leave comments on what you think the next Japanese true crime episode should focus on. I have my list of research that I've worked on, but I'm keen to hear what your thoughts are. Pop them in the comments. Whether you are a supporting member or a free member, it doesn't matter. Reach out to me on any one of my channels, including X or aka Twitter. Now I want to thank the amazing supporters that keep this show running. I am so, so lucky to have the support of my friend and majestic superstar, a god amongst gods, to my Ode Night Tea Titan, Matto Star.
Matto Star!
Your unwavering support is legitimately the bedrock upon which these investigations are built. Just as the ancient woods of Japan stood firm while the cities trembled, your presence provides the strength needed to navigate these atmospheric depths. You are my silent sentinel, Matto, of this channel, ensuring the stories that deserve to be told are never ever lost to the fog of time. Thank you so, so much for your support, mate. It is unparalleled and I am grateful for it. Matto, I have a question for you as we close this file. In your view, did the Phantom truly win by vanishing into the void of history? Or was the introduction of the pop cap a mechanical defeat that finally silenced their dark ambition? What are your thoughts? Thank you again so much, Matto, and have a fantastic week ahead. You are brilliant. And now onto my White Tea Warlords.
White Tea Warlords.
First up is Lesosaurus Rex. You are the steel in our ranks. While we navigated the clinical dread of the Paraquat Spree, your presence acted as a shield against the suffocating silence of the stone lungs. Thank you for standing as a sentinel with myself, the Tale Teller, and for your unwavering strength during this long, cold watch. Leza, as we look back at the found fortune of those retrieval slots, do you believe the Phantom chose Orunamin C specifically for its medical reputation, or was it simply the perfect amber mask for the blue poison? What's your thoughts? And thank you so much, Leza, for your amazing support and your brilliant friendship. Have an epically fantastic week ahead. My next White Tea Warlord, Maya, the Queen of Cats, your insight is the lantern that illuminates the darkest corners of these files. You have a keen eye, a feline eye, a cat's eye for patterns hidden within the forensic void, seeing the hand of the killer where others see only a ghost. Thank you for your sharp intuition and for guiding the community through the mechanical traps of 1985. Maya, considering the night of the syringe, do you think the Phantom found their thrill in the moment of injection or in the weeks of voyeuristic silence that followed each claim? What are your thoughts? And thank you so much, Maya, for your support and friendship. Have a great week. And of course, my final White Tea Warlord, Sangeetha, your ability to see into the future and to adhere to the lore in the thread that binds these tragedies into a legacy of remembrance, you ensure that the names of the 13, from the first father in Hiroshima to the final girl in Saitama, are never truly lost to time. Thank you for being a steadfast guardian of the Nocturne Archives and supporting me so I can place these tales front and center. Sangeetha, after witnessing the blue confirmation in the hospital wards, do you feel the introduction of the pop caps was a true victory for the public, or did it just teach us to fear the silence instead? What are your thoughts? And thank you so much, Legend, for supporting me in the way you do. You're absolutely brilliant. And now I want to thank the absolute legends that support me in the way that they do. I am so lucky to have Chad Warren, Peter Raffaelli, Just Heather, Juicebox Andy, Divided by Zero, Paige Kramer, Kimberly Suzanne Fletcher, Jane Gumnick, Michael Krupp, and Steve the Creeper. Thank you so, so much for your support. Stay tuned for the next episode next weekend, where I'm covering off more true crime and unsolved Japanese mysteries. And like I said, if you want to reach out to me, you can do so via Patreon, my email, and don't forget, if you do get any time spare, please leave an iTunes or a review on your favorite podcast platform. You are amazing, and don't let anybody else tell you otherwise. This is the Tale Teller signing off for this weekend. Have a brilliantly safe week ahead of yourself, and I will see you very, very soon. In fact, next Sunday. Thank you so much, and have a great week ahead.